Chapter 10. Attacked and Beaten in Indonesia. During my talks, audience members sometimes refer to news reports that Nike and similar companies are improving. I, like most people I meet, want to believe this. We hope that Nike founder Phil Knight and other executives in leadership positions act responsibly. I contacted Leslie and Jim, the couple who had tried to live like Nike factory workers in Indonesia, and were now producing a documentary movie about sweatshops. Their emailed reply was not reassuring. Since our trip in 2000, we have returned twice and have kept in contact with workers and labor organizers. Marginal changes at best have been made, but the real issues of wages and the rights to form independent unions are no better for workers now than they were in 2000, despite Nike's attempts to make the public think otherwise. The government minimum wage has risen in Indonesia, but the price of food, water, cooking oil, clothing, housing, and other basic necessities has risen at the same rate. Workers are still forced to make decisions like, eat or let my child eat. The last time we were in Indonesia, a Nike factory worker, whom we have interviewed since 2000, and who has worked in a Nike factory for 8 years, came to greet us. She gave us a solemn hug, a strained half-smile, and said forcefully, "Nothing's changed." What has changed is the price of oil, and therefore the cost of transportation to and from the factories. It now costs workers up to 30% of their already inadequate salary just to get to and from work. Where does the money come from for increased transportation costs? The women and men working 6 to 7 days a week for multi-billion dollar corporations are sometimes forced to eat rice with salt for their 2 meals per day. In the late 1990s, Nike responded to criticism about sweatshop conditions, saying that critics didn't know what they were talking about, and that the subcontracted factories were owned by someone else. Therefore, Nike did not have the power to make changes. In 2000, Nike's response was, quote, "Right issue, wrong company," unquote. By 2002, Nike executives were following us around the U.S. at the colleges and high schools where we gave lectures on this subject. They would send a packet prior to our visit denouncing what we were going to say, then follow up with an editorial in the student newspaper claiming that we didn't have all of the facts. And now, Nike's strategy seems to involve attending social responsibility conferences and admitting that there are some problems, but that the answers lie in all stakeholders working together on Nike's terms. Meanwhile, the same problems uncovered in the 1990s, from starvation wages to bathroom breaks limited to twice a day, to verbal, physical, and sexual abuse, to threats and physical violence toward union organizers, continue to occur in Nike's factories around the globe. If Nike were to double all of their workers' wages in Indonesia, roughly 1/6 of their workforce, it would cost them approximately 7% of their $1.63 billion advertising budget. If Nike redirected a portion of their advertising budget to paying the factory more money per good, we could see most of these sweatshop labor conditions vanish. Leslie and Jim may be the antithesis of EHMs, but they are not beyond the reach of the jackals. They told of a dark night when they, their cameraman Joel, and their Indonesian driver and translator were chased down by a group of armed thugs. "They surrounded our car and motorcycles," Jim said. "Our driver raced to a nearby army checkpoint, but the soldier there waved us through. He was frantic to get rid of us," Leslie added. "He wasn't about to cross those guys, the equivalent of an Indonesian mafia. Our driver was forced to pull over. We were hustled out at gunpoint and pushed around. I thought sure," Leslie said with a visible shudder, "that we were goners, would be listed among the disappeared. They survived, but their driver was severely beaten." "A warning," Joel muttered. "Did you get the message?" I asked. "We'll be more careful in the future," Jim responded. "Watch where we go, at what hour, But we will go back. We will complete this documentary and show it to the world. Reading articles about SWEC, Freeport-McMoRan, and Newmont, and hearing from Jim, Leslie, and Joel about their experiences forced me to come face to face once again with the legacy of my own actions and those of everyone who purchased a sweatshop made goods and products derived from exploitative industries. Indonesia's story is one that has been repeated over and over. It is the secret history of the American empire. Unfortunately, that empire has established itself as a new standard, a model that, despite its obvious failures, is being emulated. A 2004 trip to Tibet taught me that China has its own brand of EHMs and jackals. Ultimately, theirs may prove more effective and destructive than ours. Chapter 11. Don't Become a Buddhist. Tibet is famous as the homeland of the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader who represents, perhaps more than any other living person, a commitment to nonviolence. However, Tibet has not always enjoyed such a reputation. Between 609 and 649 AD, the Tibetan king Sangsten Gampo formed alliances among warring chieftains intent on conquering neighboring fiefdoms. As a result, the king was able to forge a vast empire. Later, the region was invaded by Genghis Khan. It became part of an empire that has gone down in history as the epitome of brutality. In June 2004, I led a group of 34 people to Tibet. Driving through the countryside, toward our first stop, the city of Sedang, it became obvious that one of our female guides knew little about Tibet and barely spoke its language. In fact, it appeared that Susie's awkward English was better than her Tibetan. Word quickly spread that she was a Chinese spy and we should be careful of what we said. Our Nepalese guide quietly confirmed this to several of us and asked us to spread the word. One time when Susie got off the bus at a rest stop, he told us that we should always assume that we were being listened to by someone. "Even in the monasteries and temples?" a woman asked. "Especially in those places," he replied. Sedang sits on a Tibetan plateau. Overshadowed by snow-capped Himalayan peaks, it is one of this land's most ancient centers of civilization. We checked into a sterile Chinese hotel. I deposited my bags in my room and headed out. I felt the need to get away from the group for a spell, adjust to the altitude, walk off my jet lag, and experience Tibet. However, as I wandered around in the late afternoon, I was appalled to discover that had I been deposited on Sedang streets by a magic carpet, I would never have guessed that I had arrived in old Tibet. Instead, I would have thought I had landed in a Chinese military base. Uniformed soldiers hustled along the newly cemented sidewalks. Open-air markets and small shops sold Chinese produce. Sidewalk vendors hawked garishly colored plastic utensils, pails, and toys. While a few ancient buildings remained, many had been replaced by military-gray concrete structures. The Tibetan people stood out in their traditional clothes, like museum oddities in 15th-century fur hats, boots, and coats. They were apparent strangers in their own land. The soldiers regarded them with disdain, as they might treat deranged beggars. Tension rippled through the thin Himalayan air. As I walked on, I was burdened by a fatigue that grew more severe with each step. At first, I blamed it solely on the altitude, similar to the Andes and Kashmir. Fatigue soon turned to dizziness. I felt nauseated. I made my way to a cement bench and sat down. The slogan "Free Tibet" rang in my ears, and I realized that I was suffering emotionally as well as physiologically. I forced myself to focus on my surroundings. People scurried past. The many Chinese and the few Tibetans appeared not to notice me. I felt visible and vulnerable, yet apparently no one saw me sitting there. I too could have been a deranged beggar. When I began to recover, I remembered the photo of the Dalai Lama I carried in my pocket. I reached for it cautiously, aware that merely possessing it could land me in prison. Photos of this man are illegal in modern Tibet, despite the fact that millions there still consider him their leader. I had smuggled it past the Chinese security guards at the airport partly out of defiance, partly because I thought I might gift it to one of his followers, but mostly to honor the time I had spent with His Holiness nearly 5 years earlier. The organizer of this trip, Sheena Singh, had also arranged that 1999 trip. We had journeyed into the Indian protectorate of Ladakh in the Kashmir region between Pakistan and India, which today is populated by thousands of Tibetan refugees who are determined to carry on the traditions forbidden by the Chinese in their homeland. As fate would have it, the Dalai Lama was in Ladakh that same week. Sheena knew of his interest in indigenous cultures. She sent one of my books on the subject to him, along with a note requesting a private audience for our group. A day later, several of his staff arrived at our hotel with a gracious reply explaining that his calendar was full. They presented us with a box of his autographed books. On our last morning in Tibet, as we waited to board our flight to northern India, we were surprised to see the Dalai Lama and his entourage sweep into the tiny airport. Sheena immediately approached his secretary. The boarding process began. Before I realized what had happened, I found myself being hustled up the steps of the plane, prepped by our Indian guide that protocol dictated kissing one of the Dalai Lama's shoes, and led to the front row of the Boeing 737. The Dalai Lama smiled up at me and patted the seat beside him. The idea of kissing a shoe seemed rather odd, but having learned long ago the importance of respecting local traditions, I awkwardly started to lean over the seat toward his foot. The Dalai Lama gave a little laugh and, placing a hand beneath my chin, gently lifted my head. "Not necessary," he said in that softly chuckling voice that the world has come to love. He patted the seat again. "Please sit." He tapped the edge of a book he was holding on his lap. "Wonderful," he said, turning the front cover of my book toward me. "I'd like to learn more." We talked extensively about indigenous people and their commitment to balance. I told him that the reason the Shuar of the Amazon became headhunters and went to war was, according to their own mythology, because they had allowed their populations to grow out of control and that the resulting imbalances threatened to destroy many life forms. Consequently, a god ordered them to take responsibility, even if that required weeding your own garden, killing other men. This story seemed to strike a chord with the Dalai Lama. He observed that, while he did not condone violence, peace arrives only when humans show true compassion for all sentient beings, and when we take individual and collective responsibility for good stewardship of the planet. He pointed out that economic development usually destroys other life forms and creates disequilibrium, making the rich richer and the poor poorer. We discussed at length the importance of taking actions to make this a compassionate world, not simply talking about it or praying for it. After that flight, the Dalai Lama invited our group to his home in Dharamsala, India. Following a cordial greeting, he said something that seemed most unusual, given his position as the leader of a spiritual movement. "Don't become a Buddhist. The world doesn't need more Buddhists. Do practice compassion. The world needs more compassion." Those words echoed in my mind as I sat on the bench in Sedang, cupping that photo in my hands. I could not imagine hearing such advice from the Pope, nor from China's head of state, nor from the President of the United States. It was a direct refutation of proselytizing and of all forms of imperialism. Staring at the Dalai Lama's photo, contemplating his insistence that his people not enter a cycle of violence that would taint future generations, I felt my own inadequacy. I was furious at China. Here in this city that epitomized the brutality of colonial empires, I felt the inappropriateness of my own anger. I made a vow then and there that I would devote the rest of my life to turning things around. I would write and speak out about the dangers of a world based on exploitation, fear, and violence. I would search for real solutions and try to inspire people to take concrete actions. At the same time, I understood that I had to work on my own attitudes. I realized that it was not enough to exchange one empire for another, to fight fear with more fear. We had to break that cycle. Chapter 12. Biological Imperatives. We explored Tibet in a convoy of 8 Toyota Land Cruisers. As we passed peasants trudging under heavy loads, I could not help thinking that we must convey the impression of feeling superior, that we are the chosen people. When we stopped for a restroom break high in a mountain pass, I wandered over to a cluster of our people and joked that we must appear to the locals like a caravan of royalty. "Are you kidding?" one of the men scoffed. "This is a trip from hell. We got cars, sure, but my driver can't even shift properly. Grinds gears all the time. The cruiser ahead of us leaks oil." "That one," he pointed at a cloud of dust on the road behind us, "can't keep pace with the rest. I don't think royalty would tolerate this." It was true that, by American standards, the trip was rough. We struggled over ancient silk roads that at times were no more than potholed riverbeds. The thin Himalayan air took a toll on both vehicles and people. At one stop, we were inundated by clouds of biting insects. On the other hand, the scenery was spectacular beyond imagination, and we usually enjoyed clean beds and decent food. We talked with nomads who defied Chinese edicts not to speak to foreigners. Our guides dutifully showed us the home of the Panchen Lama, who at 6 years old had been hand-picked by the Chinese to replace the boy previously chosen by the Dalai Lama, who had disappeared. Since the Panchen Lama must confirm the next Dalai Lama, Buddhist monks and civilians alike took to the streets in protest. Untold numbers were imprisoned, expelled, and executed. As we continued along, we paid our respects at numerous monasteries that had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. Traveling around Tibet, time and again we witnessed Chinese oppression. It had a profound impact, serving as a constant reminder that Tibet was an occupied land, its people enslaved, its natural wealth exploited. We discussed the idea that the United States behaves in similar fashion in countries with resources our corporations covet. Several of the participants had traveled to the Amazon with me. They had witnessed the terrible destruction of cultures and rainforests at the hands of our corporations. They had heard the voices of indigenous people determined to die fighting, if necessary, to protect their offspring against our encroaching materialism. They had seen U.S. soldiers wandering the streets of Amazonian towns in a fashion similar to that of the Chinese in Tibet. Members of our group often compared the Chinese presence with that of the United States government and our oil, lumber, beef, pharmaceutical, and consumer goods companies throughout the Amazon, Middle East, Africa, and Asia, and in the wars of occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq. On our way back to Lhasa, and knowing that we would depart for Nepal the following morning, we drove across the spectacular Khero La and Khamba La passes. At 17,000 feet, our caravan stopped to view a glacier. One of our guides explained that the ice had reached almost to the road 2 decades earlier, but changes in climate had caused it to recede by a quarter mile or more. Sheep and yaks grazed beside our vehicles. Between them and the glacier were several black tents. Roughly shoulder height and perhaps 12 by 15 feet, they were firmly anchored to the ground by heavy straps that traversed their ridge poles. Smoke poured through their roofs. Behind the tents, red, blue, yellow, green, and white prayer flags, suspended from a series of tall poles interconnected by a web of twine, fluttered in the chill breeze that swept down off the glacier. As we stepped out of the cruisers, Tibetans emerged from the tents. The men wore woolen slacks, heavy jackets, and caps, the women long dresses festooned with brightly colored aprons. Our guides explained that they were nomads who lived much as their forefathers did before the time of Christ. Through our interpreters, the nomads told us that Yetis, abominable snowmen, lived on the glacier. They assured us that until recently, they had seen them several times a year. But over the last 10 years, with the glacier receding, the Yetis had vanished. As we talked about the devastating impact of global warming on the Earth's glaciers, someone noticed that the nomads had set up a little stand, and that one of our women, famous for her ability to hone in on a bargain, was hustling from it toward us. She informed the group that the nomads were selling crystals they had found on the ground vacated by the glacier. The majority of our people rushed to the vendor's stand as the word quickly circulated that this would be the last opportunity to buy directly from the people, as opposed to Lhasa stores. When I asked a guide about the authenticity of the crystals, he muttered that he did not want to interfere with the nomads' income. Then, shaking his head, he added that he had heard about a factory in China that produced such things. I and a couple others stood watching as our group bargained with the Tibetans. "So much for global warming," one of my companions observed. "There's that magnificent glacier," the other said. "Here are these tents, the people, yaks, and our group gets seduced by crystals that are probably nothing more than glass." Asking a translator to accompany me, I approached an old man and woman and a young girl who were sitting nearby. The old woman was holding a long rope that was attached to a yak. The animal's shaggy back was covered with a beautiful blanket decorated with brown and tan triangles. Thrown across it was a small saddle that I took to be the little girl's. The three of them smiled warmly at me. The old woman stood and brought the yak to my side, offering to let me pat it. Then she sat back down and invited me and the translator to join them. After introductions, I asked how they felt about the Chinese. They glanced at each other. The girl hid her face and peered through spread fingers, first frowning at me and then giggling. The old man spoke up. "You know," he said with a toothless grin, "we are accustomed to rulers from other lands. Our stories go back long before my grandparents' grandparents, of kings who invaded us. We have a name for their soldiers. Nomad killers." He patted the girl on the shoulder. "Why should things be different in her time?" "The problems began," the old lady continued, "when men took over." I asked what she meant. "Look at today. Everything is run by men. I once lived in the city and tried Buddhism, but I saw that all the important jobs there, just like the government, were held by men." "I have to agree," the old man said. "In past times, the women kept us men under control," he grinned. "We can get pretty wild, hunting and cutting forests, that sort of thing. The women used to say when we had done enough." This talk reminded me of the Shuar of the Amazon. They believe that men and women are equal yet have different roles. Men kill animals for food, cut trees for firewood, and fight other men. Women raise children, grow crops, tend the household fires, and have the very important job of telling men when it is time to stop. The Shuar explained that men hunt animals and cut trees even when there is enough meat and wood, unless women rein them in. When members of the Shuar visited the United States, they were shocked by the way nature had been destroyed and paved over with highways, cities, and shopping malls. "What happened to the women?" they asked. "Why haven't they stopped the men? Why do your women always want to buy more things?" It was amazing to find similar sentiments among tribes deep in the Amazon and nomads at the top of the Himalayas. On the drive back to Lhasa, I kept thinking that perhaps those two groups represented true human values, and that to change the world, all we had to do was bring the male and female into balance. Given the corporatocracy's maleness and its interests in promoting mass consumption, the all we had to do was a pretty big all. Nevertheless, defining it made the task seem less daunting. The important fact was that the corporatocracy's structure was based on masculine hierarchies, and its power revolved around our willingness to accept as normal an extreme form of materialism. I also realized that we had to get both genders off the shopping addiction. how indicative that the U.S. president, after 9/11, urged citizens to go shopping to reduce stress, bolster the economy, and defy terrorists. Even here in Tibet, yak herders, who were far removed from the world of shopping malls, had received the message. Despite their own non-consumptive lives, they were selling to us.